so. Great, thanks, Mark. Okay, so everybody have the slide pages. Well, I'm gonna have them up here too, but I have got a whole set. I got like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 more sets there. So anybody who needs one can grab it. If anybody is, I'm trying to remember, I'm doing a 5-week, just kind of a separate thing. I'm doing a 5-week class on teaching, and we're really going from a real foundational level, just trying to, what is teaching? What does it mean to teach? And then kind of building up to some thinking about how we as teachers prepare ourselves for a class. And if anybody is interested in that, the next one will be on Sunday the 21st, because not this coming, not next Sunday, but the Sunday after. And if you're interested at all, I have a whole series of articles that everybody in the class is reading. I think I've got about 8 people or so in it, but I'm inviting everybody else. Everybody's invited to it. And these articles are going to talk about two main philosophies of teaching. The classical view of education, which is called in Latin, the trivium, and the modern view of education, which is it's often referred to as outcome-based education. So if you're interested, you can grab one of these articles or one of those sets of articles and read them in the next couple weeks. So if you're interested in that, feel free. Here's one that's not staples. There are 4 there. Okay, so we are coming to Noah's Ark. Now we're going to get into the actual more science of Noah's Ark here. Basically, is Noah's Ark feasible or is it unbelievable? What are some of the skeptics, maybe even things you could think about yourself or things you've heard, what are some of the skeptics or criticisms of Noah's Ark that are out there?
Can't fit so many animals in one place.
Okay. And what does that critique assume?
That they're bringing on board every species of every little and big thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Which didn't all exist at the time.
Exactly.
You mean there were no pools on the ark?
No.
Probably just wolves.
Yeah. In fact, it might have been an animal, especially with dogs. It might have been something that gave rise to wolves and foxes and who knows? Even the hyena is even in the family, remember, right? I don't remember exactly, but we just don't know. We do know the birds. I mean, the birds, he talks about a dove and a raven, so it's not just like a pair of birds. So there are multiple different types of birds. But what other kinds of skeptics?
Critics? There wouldn't be enough food for all the animals. Yeah. Argument.
Exactly. And every picture you've ever seen of Noah's Ark, I mean kind of drawing or whatever, it always shows big full-size animals getting on, right? They love the giraffe, and the giraffe's next to Canaveral. Right? So, there's not enough space, which I really think goes to, I don't think anybody who hasn't studied it in much detail, I think a lot of Christians probably can, but I think even a lot of Christians who've just kind of read it, oh yeah, 300 cubits is in it, I don't think most people can grasp how big it is. I think that's one of the great problems. Is one is how big it is. So there's really kind of 2 issues, even the ones you mentioned. There's the issue of how many animals do we need to bring on? And then the second is, well, how much space is there? And so both of those things I think are not understood, and they're definitely not understood by the average person. Because this would be a highly debatable, both of those, not the size, But the, like, how many animals would have had to be on board? If you were to take the best, you know, biology sciences in the world, you know, zoologists, and say, okay, I want you to, you know, think of what are the kinds we would need to give rise to all the species that exist today. They would debate that. They would, just on the dog. Dog's one of the great examples because we see it, right? We know poodles, or a let's think of something like a labradoodle. Well, that's a modern creation, isn't it? Even 100 years ago, a labradoodle didn't exist in the way we think of it now. Because now a labradoodle comes from a purebred Labrador and a purebred poodle. They're mixing together. Now, part of the reasons they're doing all of these mixing of certain pured lines is because we're getting to genetic problems of all the pure lines of dogs. It's why sometimes your rescue pet is often healthier than a purebred. Most purebreds have got innate genetic issues in them because they've been so interbred within that subspecies for so long. And these are, how many animals is a hard thing to figure out. We're actually going to look at the science of that down the road. Actually, how many animals, how many species are there, how many families are there? Because certainly in the family, like canines, all canines, they interbreed with each other. At the family level, not the species level. At the species level, this is kind of a little forerunning. The species level, there's some, we estimate between 50, I don't know, millions of different species that exist of animals. But when you get down to the families, now you're only talking thousands. There's only thousands of types of families. And so, and our classification of the way we classify animals may not be God's. You know, we may have things, you know, split apart very differently than God did. By the way, attacks on this, these are not recent things. The attacks on Noah's Ark date into the very earliest centuries of the church. You're like, oh, that couldn't have really happened. And yet it was generally accepted until about the middle of the 18th century, which is, I don't know if everybody here, the 1700s became what is known in kind of human history, or at least Western civilization thinks of it as the Age of Reason. And what happened is, it began after the, we think of the Dark Ages, and then we think there was this Renaissance period where people began to explore and learn, and all of a sudden they weren't going to, you know, the backwoods ways of the past were no longer going to be, you know, like, tolerated, and everybody was going to kind of just grow and learn. And then there became, after that Renaissance period, became this concept, well, we need to put aside the old myths, and we need to study these things to see whether they're true or not true. And so I don't know if everybody has heard the story. Most everybody heard the story of Thomas Jefferson reading his Bible every day. He read his New Testament every day in Greek. Okay, so he was a Greek-speaking, you know, reading person. So pulled up in his New Testament Greek and read it. But he actually, and I've heard a couple of different versions of this, he either skipped or he actually cut out of his Bible the miracles that Jesus did, because he didn't believe they were true. They were myths, because we can't prove those. Those are unprovable things. Those belong to mythology, which he is part of that whole group. All the people who founded the United States, by the way, were part of the group of people who consider themselves in the Age of Enlightenment, Age of Reason. So they were no longer just accepting mythology as the basis for anything. And so they rejected things that they could not witness. That's why Thomas Jefferson rejected miracles, because he didn't see miracles. So therefore they couldn't be true, is how he approached it. And so that was a real common theme for quite a while. And so Noah's Ark, it took probably 100 years or so of the Age of Reason, because during that time frame, people began, and we have in the 1800s, you know, these kind of all coincide with one another. The time frame of Noah's Ark begins to be questioned is about the same time frame as the Origin of the Species comes around. Darwin's Origin of the Species, because he's starting to look at, okay, here's all these animals out here. We're starting to classify all the animals that exist in the world. The truth is, we still don't know all the animals. We still occasionally find animals we either thought were extinct, or we're like, what's that? And I don't know if anybody saw that. I saw something. Where did I see that? It might have been on Facebook. Yeah. But anyway, it was in another country, somebody fishing. It's in Portugal, for the right. And they had had on this hook this fish, which had, it was the oddest looking. I don't know if somebody, you know, did some weird, you know, I don't know if people were, you know, playing around with a video or, you know, stuff, but this is the weirdest looking thing that anybody ever pulled off a hook I've ever seen. And I'm like, well, would anybody have an idea what this is? I didn't see any answers to it, but it's like, it almost had arms coming out of its belly. It had what looked like things, and like a tail, and this kind of a big head, almost like, it wasn't big, but it was like, you know, almost a stingray-shaped head with what looked like almost arms coming out of the bottom of it, and it was like, that was bizarre. There's, you know, maybe it's just a mutation of some sort, but, okay, so we have, the criticism essentially boils down to the size of the boat, or the ark. The amount of animals we would need to put on, the amount of food we need to put on. Any other skepticism you can think of?
The source of enough water to cover the surface of the earth.
Okay. So then you have, you know, could you really have that much flood? And I'm probably not getting into that one a lot. I have some other books to talk about. There's actually, in the rocks alone of the earth, is more than enough water to cover the world.
Darren covered it quite a bit in the previous class, too. So
there's some calculation, because even rock, when we dig down, we find hard bedrock, it has water in it. We see that. Rock gets wet, and it has a wet look to it. What does that mean? It's absorbed moisture. When it dries out, you put it out in the sun, and it has a different look to it, because all the moisture is evaporated out of it, right? That moisture went somewhere. It doesn't cease to exist. And so water, whether it's in vapor form or liquid form, exists in this. And I would say the creation story implies that water isn't like being newly created. It just exists. It transforms and, you know, changes states and, you know, comes into us, it goes out of us, it goes back into, you know, it's a big cycle of water. And also, you know, if you were to remove the mountains, if you were to, you know, lower everything, water would cover most of it. Because there's a lot more water in the universe than there is, you know, land mass. In part because the land mass is, you know, jutting up. Back in the 1800s, though, at that time, they were thinking a few hundred mammals. So they were picturing, that's one of the reasons they pictured these boats, small boat with a handful of animals on it, because they only had in their mind, you know, a handful, you know, hundreds of animals, hundreds of pairs you would need to put on it. And so if that were true, it really would have been fairly easy to get it into this ark. Currently, this actually goes back a ways. It might even be a little bit more than this now, because this information is about 15 years old or so. 5,000, and I think you can probably Google it, find out. The number of mammalian species known today, about 5,000. Okay. And basically, as our knowledge of all the different animals has grown, basically the skepticism of the ark has grown with it. And that's a general thing. No way you can do that. So this leads to a bunch of revisions. Prior to the middle 1800s, the ark was either the whole thing, or the whole world, or nothing, right? Well, what happened was after this, a lot of Christians really began to go, well, I guess the science is telling us it's impossible. So, what do we do? We become believers? No. What Christians have done essentially is kind of adopted our thinking about it. Well, maybe these passages in the Genesis are just, they're just local. Maybe this was just a Tigris-Euphrates. You guys know where that is, coming out of the Persian Gulf, the Tigris-Euphrates go up. Maybe just that whole area of Iraq, Iran, today flooded. And nothing else. Now, of course, a lot of that's flat. And the Persian Gulf, you know, you have to go way north up into the mountains of Ararat and things, the northern Iran area. But if that was covered, if the mountains of those were covered, it'd be hard enough to cover most of the earth. But that's the thought. Well, maybe this was just a local flood. This was not a, you know, a worldwide flood. Maybe that accounts for why that many species could have gotten, and Noah only had to get the number of animals in his area to save them. Okay? And so, because science said, well, Noah's Ark is absurd, it's inconceivable from a scientific perspective, therefore, we either don't believe it, or we kind of come up with a local flood theory. So what we want to talk about is why not a local flood to some degree. And so just a couple of things here. Skeptics point to the Bible Ark as an example of the absurdity of taking the Bible accounts literally. The Bible provides very little detail about the design and outfitting of the Ark. We don't have to prove exactly how it was done, but only that there is at least one way that it could have been done. That's what we're doing in this class, by the way. In a feasibility study, you're not saying this is the way it's done. But if we could say, we could do this, if this would work, then it's possible. Then it's no longer scientifically absurd or inconceivable. And that's what a feasibility study is. It's not saying this is how it happened. This is saying it's possible it could have happened because look at these things. These are possible ways to have done it. And in this book, by the way, he even takes into account the knowledge known in the ancient world. So we're not just looking at modern understandings of how to deal with waste management, for example. He looks at what did the modern ancient world do. Emperor Trajan supposedly had a zoo for himself of, I don't remember the exact number, 11,000, 12,000 animals. A lot bigger than our zoo. Probably bigger than San Diego Zoo. And so in the ancient world, they knew how to manage animals. It wasn't like, because remember, and I think probably to a greater extent, I think more people knew how to manage animals a long time ago than we do. How many people here know how to really take care of animals? I was watching yesterday. I was on a cooking show. One of the guys on the Food Network traveling through Europe with his son, and they go to this farm in Greece where they're milking the sheep. And he grew up in Northern California, and he actually grew up with sheep, and so he's like, I got this. The way they milk the sheep, just cracked them all up. They grab the sheep, and the sheep are trying to bug here, and they clamped on with their legs, and they melt them in there. And they milk each sheep. It took them 2 minutes to milk each sheep into the bucket. But then they run off, and they start jumping and going crazy. Both of the guys were like, these Greek men had been doing it the exact same way for their grandfathers and great-grandfathers. They've been doing this forever. And so here comes guys that think, they grew up on a farm in Northern California and think, I got this. And wow, this is different. Taking care of animals is a talent and is a knowledge base that many of us, that essentially has been lost other than to those few who know it. Actually, in our modern society, it really is disappearing. There's a lot of abilities, a lot of talents that are kind of disappearing based on our culture and our scientific ways. And so, actually, maybe it's better to say that it's becoming more, knowledge is becoming not so universal and becoming much more specialized. Everybody has got a certain little niche of knowledge rather than a general knowledge of many things. So anyway, what we're studying is basically possibilities. Is the Ark feasible? This is the book, which I've already shown you guys. So he's actually got a master's and bachelor's in geology as well as a bachelor's in biology. So it's not like, so especially talking about rocks and animals, it's not like he is unfamiliar with all of these things. And like he says, while not questioning the possibility of miraculous activity in connection with the care of the animals, we're not going to consider miracles in this class. Okay? Because the book, the account in Genesis does not account for many miracles. God doesn't talk about miraculously doing a lot. There's some implications. He may have had the animals come to Noah. They came. And it's the phrasing of they came. It seems to imply that maybe they came to him. He didn't have to go get them. But there's other times it's written where, you know, you have to take them in. And so we're not really sure. There's hardly any way to be sure about how much God was doing and how much Noah had to do. And so we're not going to account for miracles. The only miracle that essentially is mentioned, and we've already mentioned it, is what? The sealing of the door. He said, closed it, and God said he sealed the door for them. But other than that, there's no mention of God miraculously doing anything for Noah. And so there's obviously many, many details that are completely left out. So, for example, I suspect Noah was given instructions. Besides just the dimensions and the type of wood, I suspect he was told how to put it together. But maybe he already had that knowledge, I don't know. Possible. I suspect he was given essentially a plan of what the ark was supposed to be, so that much like, you know, Moses was given a plan for the tabernacle, we were told God gave him us here, build it exactly according to my specifications. Now, we're told the tabernacle and temple plans were incredibly detailed. I mean, just to the ornament thing that held the curtains, you know, everything was completely detailed. I suspect he had something like that, but I don't know. Doesn't tell you. So, so why not a local flood? So, if you were to, because you'll hear this, and sometimes you'll hear from Christians. Why are people feeling compelled to say, well, God, it might just be a local flood? I think almost most of the commentaries I read about this Genesis account of the flood almost always say, well, it could have been just from Noah's perspective. So what do you think? It doesn't sound that way, right?
Well, at the very end of the flood, he says, I'll never flood the whole earth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and we'll look at that verse here in a second, too, specifically. But you're right, and you're picking up on it. So it sure reads like every, right? And so when you look at the accounts, and let me just kind of pull this up here, so I think it's 6. So, sorry, like 22. So when we have the flood coming on, you know, when God, even going back to Genesis 6, when God says, you know, man is corrupt, is he only talking about the people on this continent? People other places aren't corrupt. When he talks about, you know, man began to fade, you know, multiply on the face of the earth, you know, the sons of God, daughters of men, all of that, And God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Is that a commentary on all people, or is that a commentary only on some people?
It sounds like all people.
Now, the earth, by the way, the term earth is sometimes used of just local areas. Okay, it doesn't always mean the whole world. But when you take it in context of the passage, how do you get from, well, only certain people? He's just judging some. So Genesis 7:22 talks about everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostril died, he says. So you kind of read the whole thing in the ESV here. He says, he blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, they were blotted out from the earth. So why not a local flood in that verse alone? Besides just this point, everything on dry land had the breath of life died. You notice anything in that verse? He blotted out every living thing on the face of the ground, man, animals, creeping things, and the birds of the heavens, they were blotted out from the earth.
And only Noah was left.
Yeah.
Well, why did the birds fly away to the other parts where it wasn't?
Because birds migrate all the time. If it's only local, why wouldn't the birds just have flown to someplace else? Because the only reason all birds would die is if there's no place for them to ever land. And so, the passage itself just doesn't really give the out that this is just a little local thing. Floodwaters cover the tops of the mountains, it mentioned, right? The waters, in verse 20, the waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. So 15 cubits, he says, basically from the tops of the mountains, he said, you have an additional, 22, 23 feet. So that's how deep it is above the top. So you're talking thousands of feet. Sometimes in some place. Now, the implication in Scripture is that the world before the flood probably wasn't as mountainous as it is after. And because, for example, the difficulty we look at our present Earth, water to cover above Mount Everest. At Mount Everest, it would be hard. It's hard. You can't even really breathe, right? So if he's floating on an ark 22 feet above the top of Mount Everest, that creates some problems, doesn't it? But science tells us, for example, all the highest mountain ranges in the world, we think to be the most recent to have jutted up. All the evidence of geology points to that the mountain ranges have jutted up. There was a push that created them. And from geology's perspective, the oldest mountain ranges are not the tallest. They're the lowest and most hilly, you might say. The Appalachian Trail in the East Coast is considered to be a very old mountain range because it's not very high and it's eroded down. And it's actually more hills than it is mountains. And, it's not jagged peaks. And yet out west, in fact, running all the way from Alaska, all the way along the coast of both North and South America, is a mountain range that juts up. In fact, any of you ever ever been to South America, I'm guessing. I never have. But you ever looked at the geography of South America? Is it Chile and Peru? They're on the coast. And they have almost no contact with the nations on the other side because it's this little strip of land along the coast of South America that has a massive mountain range that rises up from the coast to the other side. So it's actually very difficult to transgress and go across it. Much like, you know, it was for the ancient, you know, or the settlers and things that crossed the Rockies and even the Sierra Nevadas and things. So, water covering the mountaintops. I think Darren said he kind of talked about some of that, right? I think one of the Psalms kind of talks about the earth, the changing of the earth, and even the flooding of water coming out would have almost certainly changed the geography that had initially been created. But the reason it's not a local flood is you can't cover the tops of mountains. Even if you were to look at the tops of the mountains around Ararat, well, the mountains of Ararat are covered in snow today. They're covered in snow like Everest, year-round. They don't ever not have snow on them. It's worse and better, but the top's always covered in snow. So it tells us that at one point, at least in Noah's time, this wasn't true. The tops of Ararat, where he settles into, wasn't covered in snow at that time. Water was covered. So, Noah could have simply moved somewhere else. So why build a big ark if it's a local flood? Why wouldn't you? He's got 120 years. Why not just tell him to, why don't you head that way? That's what he told Abraham to do. He told Abraham to move. He could have simply told Noah to move. So the ark doesn't make a lot of sense if it's local.
Why would he need 120 years to prepare?
He certainly wouldn't need that. And
it's not going to be very well.
No need to save the animals. Why would I save the animals in a local valley? Animals would all save themselves. If it's local, they're going to find someplace. And those that don't, there's others. And so the story doesn't make any sense. The great problem of turning, this is a kind of a common theory, the great problem of turning to science, we accept science and then we try to read into scripture scientific knowledge, is one, we may be misapplying scripture, and two, we may not fully understand the science of it. We may not fully understand the truth of what we think science tells us. Like, I don't know if you guys talked about with Darren. There's some evidence, bits of evidence, possibly, that the speed of light is not constant. It's constant in our time. It appears to be constant to us, but there are some little bits of some clues that say, well, it's possible it's not. And so things that look a certain way to us scientifically doesn't necessarily have always been that way. God's promise, and this goes back to Genesis 9, verse 11. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. So his promise to Noah and his covenant and the rainbow, it's not just that doesn't make any sense. It's actually been violated. If he's referring to a local flood that kills people and animals, that has been violated a lot. It's violated by the Mississippi River almost every year. It's violated by the tsunamis that take out whole villages in certain parts of the world. We've seen, you know, but this isn't new. You and I seeing it probably is new because we, you know, have all these pictures of it. But throughout the hundreds and thousands of years, people have had catastrophes by flooding that have wiped out lots and killed lots of people and animals. This is a promise that actually is false. It can't be. This is one of those promises that you just can't have it both ways. It's either true or it's not true. A local flood makes this promise false. And so if it is a full-on global flood, and this is where it gets us to really speculate. we start speculating on the Earth, we start speculating on the continents, continental drift. There's so much speculation that can happen. I personally, when it comes to scientific speculation, or even biblical speculation of those things, don't really do it. I don't really worry about how people think God created. It's like when I talk about Scripture and teach people about believing God and a creator, I don't much care how they think God created stuff and how he even did stuff. I don't care about times. You've got to accept the young Earth, the old Earth, you used that. A lot of those details I don't care about because it's way too much speculation for me. Because when I don't argue about speculation. Because our speculations could be right on, or they could be completely off, and we have absolutely no way of knowing the difference between the two. And so I just don't spend a lot of time with that in terms of what I do is things like with the flood. What, a couple of other reasons why it's not a local flood. I kind of hinted at them last week as well. The flood story is not just in that region. I showed you the image last week, right? Of the dots all over the globe. They're on every continent. Cultures that had the essentials of the flood and a single family saving animals and saving and being the only surviving people is on every continent. And I don't know if any of you guys have all seen this. I first learned this probably back in the early 90s. One of the converts, a young girl I had taught, she was a friend of a friend, but she had grown up in China and had moved, and at that time, you know, she was going to school and helping her family at a restaurant in the Bay Area. And when she read the Old Testament, and when she studied it, she was actually quite surprised at the connection of the Chinese language to the Old Testament. So, for example, the word, and I think this is the ancient word for flood in Chinese. I'm not sure they use it still today. But the ancient word for flood, because, you know, Chinese is a pictorial language, so, you know, these. Get all of those little marks are actually little, they're got little drawings. And it is a boat with eight people on it. That is the word for flood in Chinese. So the boat with eight people on it and three above. That's actually the ancient symbol for flood. Okay? And so it hit her, and there's a number of other things all through the Old Testament, especially the early parts of Genesis. And you remember, the one of the nice things about the Chinese language, the history of Asia is far more continuous and ancient than it is in almost any other part of the world. Most other parts of the world have really severe kind of changes. They have not had that nearly as much. And so they have certain dynasties have changed, but essentially the Chinese culture and language remain the same. It goes farther back than almost any other culture and language in a continuous form. So that's one of the other things. So I didn't put them on here, but some of the evidence to me is that the flood, the story of the flood, why would Asians thousands of years ago have the flood story? It's essentially the same as those, you know, in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Why would peoples of Americas have the flood story? If it was just a local flood that happened in Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It just doesn't, that kind of, like, how does that happen? How does this concept of a worldwide flood exist in all these cultures across the whole face of the globe on every continent? So that's part of the proof to me, and part of the evidence, I should say. Why also not a local flood? It also, and I can, let me tie it into one other thing. There's another reason why I would suggest to you that the local flood makes no sense. In 1 Peter 3, verse 21, when he talks about baptism, which corresponds to this, which is the antitype of this, which right before the this is, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through water. So baptism, he says, is the opposite image of the flood, where everybody, the water, people in the flood were died. The people came, you know, in the ark, you know, were kept, came through the water and were saved. And he says, baptism, which saves you, is the opposite image, so that those in the water are being saved and those, you know, out of the water are not. But if that's not universal to all mankind, then baptism wouldn't be either, would it? It's like, well, that's just one way. It's not the only way. You might have been saved because you lived on another continent. It's like in Asia, these principles don't apply. So, yeah. Anyway, other thoughts about just the local flood or universal flood?
The idea of when it talks about the fountains of the deep pushing up, basically, it does answer so many issues, like you're talking about the Grand Canyon or the mountain ranges. Why are they so big now? Or why are the big ridges in the ocean floor and things like that? A universal flood actually ends up answering some of those scientific questions that are outside the realm of when people look at just this and what's impossible for a worldwide flood, so we'll answer it with a local flood.
Right.
But then you have all these other questions left unanswered where the universal flood actually answers more questions.
Yeah, and see, there's a couple ways. Like every mountain, the tops of every mountain range in the world have exists within the, if you dig down into the dirt, exists the, I guess archaeologically, the remains of sea life in the dirt all over the world, in every mountain range. The answer for that scientifically is that because they used to be underwater, and then they were pushed up. The pushing that created the mountain range is what caused it. Well, why was it underwater? So even science says the mountain ranges were underwater. The issue isn't that all the mountain ranges weren't underwater. It's just how. They think it was millions and millions ago when they were really low before they pushed up. And we say, well, could it have happened very quickly? And that's really, in many ways, science in the Bible is more about how quickly these things happen than if they happen. Science tells us all animals came from really similar. In fact, science says every type of canine came from a common ancestor. Now, they go further and say the common ancestor of the canine, the common ancestor of the feline came from a common ancestor. I think the Bible says that's probably not true, that, in fact, they probably had, God had specific kinds that don't go back further, and yet science in the Bible, actually, what happens is time frame. The Bible says, I mean, the science always says, it's kind of continuing. It has been continuing to happen really slowly for long periods of time for all this to happen. Because long periods of time for creation is actually something that kind of comes after scientists figure out, well, how long would it have taken for this many mutations to develop this many things? How long would that take? And we begin to calculate, oh, that's probably, it's not just millions of years. Now we're talking billions of years. And even at like 15 billion years, 20 billion years old, the newest science has gone, and some of the newest scientists who aren't even believers say the life forms that exist on this earth had to come from somewhere else. Figure probably another planet. They had to come because there's too much information for that information to have developed randomly through Darwin's, you know, random process and mutation genetically. And so there is this problem science has, and it's always solved with time. And the only thing, to science, time is God. It's what allows everything to be possible. Because if the world is 10,000 years old, can science be right? Can evolution be right? Every science, if you assume 10,000 years, I'm not saying that's accurate, it's right. 10,000 years, science isn't right. We know that. Science knows that. They have to have billions of years. And so time is their God. It's what allows everything to be possible when it comes to evolution. And what the Bible is saying, for us to believe the Bible, isn't to say, it's saying, you know, we say, okay, this had to happen over a longer time. Well, what if God just did it in a very short period of time? What would that look like? Would that account for it? What if the mountain range is just jutted up over a matter of a few months? What if, you know, the whole earth flooded in a matter of days? What would that do? You know? And so, that's, and essentially, I think that's, to me, that's the way I look at science and the Bible. It really is what's in control of the what's happening. Any other thoughts? I want you to think about yourself this week as being Noah. And I want you to try to imagine yourself, what would you have to do? What would be the challenges of what you've been asked to do? Because here's the difficulty. Does God give absolute precise details to everybody, even in the people we know in Scripture? Does he give you everything all the time? No? He doesn't. He told, God came down and told the church in Antioch to send out Barnabas and Paul. They went on a journey, came back after establishing some churches in some areas, and then they wanted to go out again. Barnabas and Paul couldn't work together anymore, so Paul and Silas went. They went to a different area. And then they were going to go to an area, and God said no. Now, he didn't say go here instead. He just said no. I'll go over here. God said no. Then he had a dream of somebody in Macedonia calling. But Paul had to figure things out. God, and I think we look at that even in Abraham. We look at that all the way through Abraham at Genesis 12, 15, 17, these different places where God talks about the covenant he's making with Abraham. He doesn't give him all the information at one time. Could you and I handle all of God's information at one time? No. We wouldn't be able to handle all of it at one time. And so, you know, I think trying to figure out what would Noah, so the very first thing he'd do, I'm thinking, okay, got to get a bunch of gopher wood then. And he's thinking, okay, I got to make it that wide by that long. How many logs are that? Well, these trees are roughly this wide. I guess I got to cut down about, 2,000 trees. So you start thinking of that. You'd have to start doing some of that. I don't know how much God's giving you. Is he telling you how many trees to cut down? Or are you having to figure out how many trees to cut down? I think that, to me, that's the biggest reason God's waiting patiently in the days of Noah, is for Noah to do all the work that he was told to do. Because Noah, essentially, is being tasked with saving mankind and animal kind. And you and I have Noah to thank for saving us in that sense, because he found God's grace. Okay, so yeah, next time when we look at how big the ark was, I want you to picture how big the ark was. Maybe even find some pictures. How big is the ark? Put that into your own perspectives. If you look at my stuff, you'll already see I have some images in there for you to kind of compare it to. But there are some images you can go get. You can go find an ancient Chinese junk and how big it was made. There's an ancient Chinese junk that was thought to have been the largest wooden ship ever built. And it actually, the historical connection to it implies it was probably near the size of the Ark. You can maybe find some of that large shipbuilding. Picture some things to help you get a sense of how big the Ark was. Okay, anything else? Everybody? I appreciate your time today. A couple minutes past noon. Is there anything we ought to be aware of for dismiss today? Got a number of people sick. I think Darren and Judy must have went home, I'm guessing. And she got up, actually. But I don't know if she left early. Okay. Anything else?
Super Bowl.
Super Bowl. Okay. Let's have a word of prayer.